Supervised learning. In supervised learning, programmers use labeled data. Before we begin using the algorithms, the data that we are looking at is already predetermined. We know the inputs and outputs we are looking for, x and y. We are trying to find a relationship between x and y that we have chosen. After you find a relationship between x and y, you get a model, which will predict an outcome based on those relationships that your machine has observed in the data. Supervised learning is used for regression and classification models. In machine learning, we refer to features as a certain measurable property or characteristic of the data. The first type of supervised learning that we'll talk about, and the first type of statistical model, is called a regression. Regression is a model where the data input and output are continuous. There are different types of regression, but the most basic form is linear regression. We use linear regression to find a relationship between some input x and an output y. Once we have estimated this relationship, we can predict y with x. Linear models can, and usually do, have more than one x. In regression, output y has a numerical value. Regression analysis. Regression is the simplest type of machine learning. This is usually where you start when you are first learning how to use your data. You have a set of x values, and you want to study their relationship with y, the output. Our independent variables, the x's in our model, are given weight. And for each value of x, it is multiplied by weight until the aggregate function creates a prediction for y. We can create a predictive model for y by using data where we already know the x and y. Regressing this information will give us the weights of x. If we have enough relevant data, eventually we will be able to predict an unknown y with known values for x. We graph our known y and x values on a scatter plot, and our regression model finds the best fit line through the data points. The regression line is called a hyperplane. The steepness of the line is called the slope. We can measure the distance between the predicted value and actual data point, and we call the measurement deviation. Our goal when we create a linear regression is to minimize the deviation in our predictions. The smaller the difference the deviation is, the more accurate your model is. Most of the statistical models used in machine learning are rooted in this first algorithm, creating a model that will predict an outcome by plotting our data points along a line or in clusters. But the line isn't always straight, and sometimes the line doesn't show us the best fit. An example of a regression function that is non-linear is the sigmoid function. The sigmoid function creates an S-shaped curve. Instead of predicting a value, the sigmoid function takes independent variables and produces a probability between 1 and 0. Simple linear regression. In simple linear regression, we study the relationship between some predicted value, y, and some predictor, x. We call our y the dependent variable, because it is dependent on the value of x. Our x is known as the independent variable. If you took algebra or pre-calculus in high school or college, then you might remember the equation of a line was y equals mx plus b. If you were to graph this equation, then you would have a graph that looks something like this. As you can see, the line shows that for every value of x, there is a different value of y. You can make a prediction for the value of y for every new value of x. In this graph, the value of y increases as the value of x increases. This is not always the case. This is the most simplistic regression, but it's important to understand how it works, because we will be building off it from here on out. Most of the statistical analysis involves a plot like the one pictured above, which makes some prediction for an output-dependent variable based on an input, the independent variable. This is an example of supervised learning, because we are specifying the y variable and the x variable that we are using before we start modeling. With almost all predictions, there will be more than one independent variable that will determine our dependent variable. This leads us to our next type of regression, multiple linear regression. In data science, and most tasks in statistics, this will be the most popular type of regression. In multiple linear regression, we will have one output variable, y, just like before. The difference now, though, is that we will have multiple x's, or independent variables, that will predict our y. An example of using multiple linear regression to predict the price of apartments in New York City real estate. Our y, or dependent variable, is the price of a New York City apartment. The price will be determined by x. Our independent variables, such as the square footage, distance to transportation, number of rooms. If we were to write this out as an expression, it would be something like apartment price equals beta 0 plus beta 1 square foot plus beta 2 dist transport plus beta 3 num rooms. We take sample data, data that we already have where we know our x's and their y's, and we look at them on a graph like this. You can see that the values of x and y don't create a perfect line, but there is a trend. We can use that trend to make predictions about future values of y. So we create a multilinear regression, and we end up with a line going through the middle of our data points. This is called the best fit line, and it's how we will predict our y when we get new x values in the future. The difference here is that instead of writing m for slope, we have written beta. This equation is pretty much the same thing as if I had written y equals b plus m1 x1 plus m2 x2 plus m3 x3. Except now we have labels, and we know what our x's and our y's are. In the future, if you see a multilinear equation, then it will most likely be written in this form. Our beta is what we call a parameter. It's like a magic number that tells us the effect that the value of our x has on the y. Each independent variable will have a unique parameter. We find the parameters by creating a regression model. Over time, with machine learning, our model will be exposed to more and more data, so that our parameter will improve and our model will become more accurate. We can create the model by using training data that has the actual price of New York City apartments and the actual input variables of square footage, distance to transportation, and many rooms. Our model will learn to approximate the price from real data. Afterward, when we plug in the independent variable for an apartment, which has an unknown price, our model can make a prediction as to what the price will be. This is supervised learning using a linear regression model. It's supervised because we are telling the model what answer we want it to give us, the price of New York City apartments. It learns how to predict the price more accurately as it is given more data, and we continue to evaluate its accuracy. Ordinary least squares, OLS, will try to find a regression line that minimizes the sum of errors squared. Polynomial regression. Our next type of regression is called a polynomial regression. In the last two types of regression, our models created a straight line. This is because the relationship between our x and our y are linear, meaning that the effect x has on y doesn't change as the value of x changes. In polynomial regression, our model will result in a line that has a curve. If we try to use linear regression to fit a graph that has non-linear characteristics, we could do a poor job of creating the best fit line. Take the graph on the left, for example. The scatterplot has an upward trend like before, but with a curve. In this case, a straight line doesn't work. Instead, with a polynomial regression, we will create a line with a curve to match the curve in our data, like the graph on the right. The equation of a polynomial will look like the linear equation, with the difference being that there will be some polynomial expression attached to one or more of our x values. For example, y equals mx2 plus b. The effect that x has on y changes exponentially as the value for x changes. Support vector regression. This is another important tool for data scientists, and one that you should familiarize yourself with. It is most commonly used in case classification. The idea here is to find a line through a space that separates data points into different classes. Support vector regression is another type of supervised learning. It's also used for regression analysis. It is a type of binary classification technique, not related to probability. In support of vector regression, all your training data falls into one category or the other. You want to find out which category a new data point falls into. Your data is separated into these two classes by a hyperplane. When you're creating a model for the hyperplane, you are trying to find a hyperplane that maximizes the distance between the two classes. For example, in the next picture, you have a scatterplot where the data points can be separated into two distinct classes. In this instance, lines 1 and 3 can separate the data points into two distinct classes. However, for your model, you should choose line 2 because it maximizes the margin between the two classes, so they are more distinct. The wider the margin is, the better. Ridge regression. This is a technique commonly used to analyze data that suffer from multicollinearity. Using ridge regression properly can reduce standard errors and make your model more accurate, depending on the characteristics of your data. Ridge regression can be useful when your data contains independent variables with a high correlation. If you could make a prediction about an independent variable by using another independent variable, then your model is at risk of multicollinearity. For example, if you are using variables that measure a person's height and weight, these variables are likely to create multicollinearity in the model. Multicollinearity can also be caused by having a model that is too specific. You have more variables than you have data points. If you have decided to use a linear model and that has made multicollinearity worse, then you can try to apply a ridge regression technique. Ridge regression works by allowing a little bit of bias into the model in order to make your predictions more accurate. This technique is also known as regularization. Another method is to improve the model's accuracy by standardizing independent variables. The simplest way is to change the coefficients of some independent variables to zero to reduce complexity. However, we won't just change them to zero, but standardization implements a system that rewards coefficients that are nearer to zero. This will cause coefficients to shrink, so the complexity of the model is less, but the independent variables remain in the model. This will give the model more bias, but it's a trade-off for more accurate predictions. Lasso regression. Lasso regression is another shrinkage technique, a very similar approach to ridge regression in that it encourages leaner, simpler models for prediction. In lasso regression, the model is a little more stringent about reducing the value of coefficients. Lasso stands for the least absolute shrinkage and selection operator. Data on our scatterplot is shrunk down to a more compact point, like the average of the data. Just like ridge regression, we use this when the model is suffering from multicollinearity. Elastic net regression. Elastic net regression works by combining the techniques of lasso and ridge regression. Its main goal is to attempt to improve upon lasso regression. It is a combination of both the methods of rewarding lower coefficients in Lasso and ridge regression. All three of these models can be accessed in the GLMNet package in R and Python. Bayesian regression. Bayesian regression models are helpful when we have insufficient data or data with poor distribution. These types of regressions are created using probability distributions rather than data points, which means that the graph will appear as a bell curve, representing the variance with the most frequently occurring values in the middle of the curve. In Bayesian regression, the dependent variable y is not a value but a probability. Rather than trying to predict a value, we are trying to predict the probability of an outcome. This is known as frequentist statistics, and Bayes' theorem makes up the foundation for this type of statistics. Frequentist statistics hypothesize whether something will happen and the probability that it will happen. When we talk about frequentist statistics, we also include conditional probability. Conditional probability involved events whose outcomes are dependent on one another. Every time you toss a coin, it is an independent event, meaning that the previous coin toss does not change the likelihood of the next coin toss. Flipping a coin toss, therefore, is not a conditional probability. Events can also be dependent, meaning that the previous event can change the probability of the next event. Say I had a bag of marbles, and I wanted to know the probability drawing different colors out of the bag. If I have a bag with three green marbles and three red marbles, and I draw a red marble, then the probability of drawing a red marble goes down on my next draw. This would be an example of conditional probability. Decision trees. One of the models that we'll discuss later is called neural networks. They're the most advanced types of machine learning and are used for many different purposes. I've related this to decision trees because of how frequently people turn to neural networks for classification problems when there are much simpler models available. Decision trees and the related random forest models can be just as useful. Despite the power of neural networks, they can't be used for everything. Fortunately, we have options, and the purpose of this book is to know what your options are and when you decide you want to build a model. The next place to look when neural networks don't work is decision trees. Decision trees break data into subcategories using decision and leaf nodes in the shape of a tree. Decision trees have a few advantages over neural networks, discussed later in this chapter. For one thing, neural networks require huge amounts of data and powerful computers in order to process them. The upside to using a decision tree is that they are relatively simple, especially when you compare them to neural networks. Unlike most of the models in this book, they are very easy to read a decision tree, even to the untrained eye. This makes them a good candidate when choosing a model that needs to be presented in front of stakeholders. Decision trees are another form of supervised learning, meaning that we label the categories that we want to sort before creating the model. In some instances, decision trees can complete regression tasks, but typically they are used as classification models. When decision trees are used for regression, the leaf nodes end in probabilities. Decision trees start with what's called a root node at the top of the tree. Then the root node is split into two nodes after the root node. Nodes are individual leaves on the tree, and the middle nodes are where the decisions are made, known as the decision nodes. The decision tree ends at the bottom, in what's called a terminal node, is at the bottom of a branch, where the decision is complete. Ideally, the decision tree will sort the data quickly, layer by layer. Because of this, we call the model greedy, because the top nodes try to sort the data as quickly as possible so that it requires fewer layers. Like neural networks, decision trees often suffer from overfitting. Decision trees often suffer from overfitting. A decision tree usually won't work with other sets of data because the sorting is so specific to each dataset. Below is an example of a decision tree about whether or not to grant a job applicant a job interview, determined by qualification factors. The root node is whether or not the applicant has a college degree, followed by the decision nodes, which all lead to either a decision not to hire or grant an interview. You can see from this decision tree why this type of model is so specific to the specific data you are working with, because every dataset will have differences in qualifications, and so every dataset will be sorted differently. Random forests. Using just one decision tree on your model can have a limiting factor on the categories that the data is split into, and the outcomes of the decisions. Because the decision trees are greedy, this means that certain categories are chosen for sorting, which prohibits other categories from also being chosen. But there is an easy way to get around that. One way to diversify your decision trees and improve the accuracy of your model is by using random forests. If a real forest is made up of several different trees, then that's exactly what a random forest is. Instead of just having one decision tree, you split the data into several decision trees. When you only have one tree, models can often suffer from high variance. Creating a random forest is a way to combat that in your model. It's one of the best tools available for data mining. A random forest is as close as you can get to a pre-packaged algorithm for data mining purposes. In a random forest, all the trees work together. The aggregate result of all the trees is usually right, even if a few trees end up with bad predictions. To create the final prediction, the results of all the trees are tallied. Using votes from the average values of all the trees gives us a final prediction. Because we are using data that is similar, there is a risk of correlation between the trees if they are trying to do the same thing. If we use trees that are less correlated, then the model will perform better. Imagine that we were to bet on a coin flip. We each have $100 and there are three choices. I can flip the coin once, and the winner of that toss gets to keep the $100. Or if I could flip the coin 10 times and we bet $10 each time. The third option is to flip the coin 100 times and bet a dollar on each toss. The true expected outcomes of each version of this game is the same. But if you did 100 coin tosses, you are less likely to lose all your money than if you only did a single coin toss. Data scientists call this method bootstrapping. It's the machine learner's equivalent of diversifying a stock portfolio. We want to have a model that gives us an accurate prediction. The more we split our decision trees, the more accurate our data will be. But it's important that the individual trees have a low correlation to one another. The trees in the forest need to be diverse. How do we avoid correlation in random forest? First, each tree takes a random sample from the dataset, so that each tree has a slightly different set of data from one another. The tree picks a feature that creates the most separation between nodes, in a greedy process, just like as individual trees. However, in a random forest, trees can only pick certain features from the overall group of features, so each tree separates by different features. So, the trees will be uncorrelated because they are using different features to make decisions about classification. In a random forest, it's best to use at least 100 trees for getting an accurate picture of the data, depending on the dataset you are working with. In general, the more trees you have, the less your model will overfit. Random forest machine learning is called a weakly supervised technique because our outcome is chosen, and we can see the sorting method, but it's up to each tree to categorize and separate variables by features. Classification models will tell us which category something falls into. The categories are defined by the programmer at the beginning. An example of a classification model could use a random forest would be a model that determines whether incoming emails should spam, go in your inbox, or spam folder. To create the model, we make two categories that our why can fall into, spam and not spam. We program the model to look for keywords or certain email addresses that may indicate spam. The presence of words like buy or offer will help the model determine whether the email message falls into the category of spam or not spam. The algorithm takes in data, and over time, it learns by comparing its predictions to the actual value of the output. Over time, it makes small adjustments to its model, so that the algorithm becomes more efficient over time.